I think that our society is desperately hungry, even starving, for that kind of practical applied wisdom. And it's not just time to let's try something new, maybe we should be trying something old.
Brett, when we were together in Australia, I found a light in me being lit when you were describing this process of intentionally transitioning from king to sage. And what I noticed was there are very few men that I can find that are engaging that transition with intentionality. And what I would say is on time. In other words, rather than reacting to circumstances that are requiring them to make some shift or reset, the forward thinking of the orientation of a masculine soul saying there is a maturing, there's a path, and there's a stage of being a sage that is in some ways one of the most perplexing of all the stages of masculine initiation on our earth at this moment. And so you were talking about retiring with this phrase of tire being our spelling with T-I-R-E, yours T-Y-R-E, but retiring, getting a new set of tires. And on you were describing, you were using language that really was lighting me up because I have been deeply pursuing thoughts, counsel, ideas, a vision for this stage of the sage. So can you just give us some background in your own story of where we find you and why you are so deeply invested in this transition into the role of sage?
Yeah, thanks, Morgan. Yes, I've been saying to people a lot, I'm getting new tires at the end of this year. I'm retiring my life. But that journey certainly had a pivotal point. I'll go by the numbers, okay? I'm turning 65 in a couple of months. I've been following Jesus now for 52 years. I've been surfing for 51 years, which is a significant part of my life because it spawned this ministry called Christian Surfers, which I've been in now for 48 years as their founding leader as a teenager in Cronulla, then the founding national director when I was 23 years old. I resigned from teaching, then founded the international role at the age of 40. And then a very significant time after, in 2016, I handed over that role as the international director and became the founder advisor and was really postured even within my organization to have a role that was no more than being an advisor, being an elder, being a sage. So I really sensed in 2016 with the language, which I've been so helped by, from Father by God, the way of the wild heart, that transition of king to sage. And I guess it happened in two ways. One, organizationally, I'd handed over the kingly role as the international director of this mission organization. And secondly, I didn't transition to some new organization or a new kingly role somewhere else, though I was offered such positions. I stayed within the organization with the posture as a sage, which then helped me to realize it's actually my next stage of calling. So much of, you know, I had a sense of calling to the culture of surfing as my mission field. Often people have a calling to a country. They may have a calling to a particular functional role. But I felt like this is a calling to a life stage, just as real as being called to a nation or a people group. I really sense God saying, you are called to step into and step up to the age of the sage. And that became a phrase from 2016 in my own soul. To transition from a king to a sage. And like you said, to do it intentionally. So often men are living on autopilot and we just react to what's coming our way and we grab opportunities and or we just are hungering for some comfort. And but that was for me a very strong sense of God's calling.
Mm.
So that's my personal historical context. So now I'm in 2024. I'm 8 years into this intentional aspect of the Age of the Sage. And at the end of this year, I'm even retiring from that official position I hold as the founder advisor. I'm in a staff role. I raise my support. I'm on various teams, but I'm feeling God is even calling me to lay even that all down. Absolutely everything being laid down.
Wow.
For him to have extra mobility and freedom to guide me in my life. So I'm heading for a 6-month sabbatical in January as I've got this theme God's given me of drawn versus driven. I'm driven by lots of motivations to do what I'm even doing in the place I am now. I'm driven by responsibility. I'm driven by this will fall over if I don't prop it up. I'm driven by they really like me in this group. But what would it be if I laid all the drivers down? What would I be drawn to? What's the difference between driven and drawn? And I want to explore that in that 6-month sabbatical. So watch that space.
Brett, just that alone has immense power. There's a weightiness of that idea of the distinction between drawn to God and driven to God. My spiritual director actually brought those exact words to me last week in preparation for a silent retreat that I'm going into, and she was naming that dilemma that we can have hearts for God and yet find ourselves where most of our life is consumed with activity. It's very reaction-based out of a good heart, but in essence, it's a life of drivenness towards God, which is not a bad thing, but it's very different than a life that's fundamentally shaped by being drawn to God. And so similarly to you, it's fascinating. Our numbers are different, but I'm in an equally fascinating transition season where I'm completing my 50 years of life, stepping into a jubilee year, and I will have been at service for over a quarter of a century at this post, at Wild at Heart and Become Good Soil. And I'm feeling this call to pause and Sabbath and enter into a deep rest. My sense is a year with the first 6 months being a deep immersion into precisely what you're naming, the space to not have the drivers and not have so many external pulls and to sink in and notice what surfaces, the good, the bad, the ugly, and hopefully access a deeper place of my identity of who I am and who God is. And from that furnace, come out with a new energy and a heightened and distilled vision of how in the next 25 years of my mission, I can focus on the few things that God is inviting me to focus on and reap the fruit of all of the slow and steady work of excavation. So I stand with you, Brett. It's beautiful to be a generation behind you and yet following that same ancient path of recovering with the goal of being drawn to God, that there's so much opposition towards that in our age. So thank you for putting words to that. What would you say, Brett, first of all, just backing off of why do you think there is even a need for a sage in society? Back me up. You know, people are gifted and God anoints leaders. And why the need for a sage?
Yeah, great question. Because our society certainly doesn't see that. It's really interesting. I've observed even in my own observation of Indigenous societies in my own country of Australia that the role of elder is very significant. And if you care to look back over history, age has always been esteemed over youth. We live in a strange time where youth is esteemed over age. Everyone wants the new young thing. We We want the youngest, brightest talent because of the rate of change, and we want the sharpest, newest insight, which is great when it comes to aspects of productivity and profitability. But what's sacrificed has to do with the depth and the character and the deeper spirituality, which in some sense only a sage can bring. So we have a Catholic church in my town that had the notice on its signboard, why is it that we are drowning in knowledge and starving for wisdom? And that statement just stood out to me that, yeah, there's a lot of knowledge, there's lots of talent, there's lots of energy, but where are you going to get acquired wisdom? So I think that our society is desperately hungry, even starving for that kind of practical applied wisdom. And it's not just time to let's try something new. Maybe we should be trying something old. And with that, a healthy, fresh respect of age and experience. And don't get me wrong, that's not automatically comes with age. There are plenty of old fools out there, and there are wise younger people. So age is no guarantee of wisdom. But the person who's truly applied themselves, you had a lifetime to grow something, and we are all growing our lives. And for the person who wants to seek God and live honorably and really press in, surely this season of life should be one of the most profitable in terms of the greatest accumulation of wisdom and experience, good and bad, successes and failures, ready to pass on as almost like a roadmap. And that's one of the great appeals to me, Morgan, is that how much we need a roadmap of life, and that guideline of the stages of the masculine journey. I see it as a great roadmap. I find it incredibly helpful to think I don't have to fumble along in the dark. There is a predictable and right roadmap for a masculine journey.
You mentioned a curious idea that there are plenty of old fools. And I think that's really helpful, especially to young men. Just because you're old or older doesn't make you wise, and it doesn't make you an elder. And I noticed the distinction, Brett, between, I would use the phrase elders and those that are simply elderly. And I know we live in different cultures, but I notice quite a few older people in different spaces in our city and in our association that their lives have shrunk in a tremendously sad way. Very little meaning, very little vision beyond themselves, very little worth, and even a sense of what the story is, and therefore the brilliant role that they could play. And so I would like to unpack a bit of when we use this phrase, you know, we can use it as an elder or a sage or even a father. Let's talk a little bit about what we mean. What is the fabric of a sage, and maybe even in contrast, where's the deficit when someone could, you know, biologically, they have stepped into that stage of life where they're no longer in the king stage as much, but sadly, they haven't passed through a sort of process. And I think I'll kick us off with one idea, and then I would love to hear from you. I would say they haven't passed through a process of initiation. I think that word is a really important word when it comes to the sage. I read a book years ago, Richard Rohr's Adam's Return. It was very helpful to me many years ago. And he describes a sage, a quality, an eternal quality of a sage being something like this. It's an initiated man, initiated into their true self, initiated into the flow of reality, initiated into the great patterns that are always true, initiated into the life of God. And he said these people take on a larger than life persona with a one common denominator. In some sense, they have all died before they have died. At some point, they were led to the edge of their own personal and private resources. And that breakdown, which surely felt like dying, led them into a larger life. And the idea that there is a roadmap, and what if that path that's unique and universal was somehow defined by a soul becoming more and more initiated into the larger story, into its true self, into the true life of God. And therefore you find a person who has enough, who you have a piece of art in your room that you're actually sitting in right now that I saw when I was there several months ago that stopped me in my tracks. And it's a translation of Psalm 23, verse 1. And I probably won't get the exact words, but I stood in front of it and it says something like, I have everything I need, carved in wood. Yeah. Did I get that right?
Yeah. I have all I need. My friend James carved that for us and it sits on the wall.
It's beautiful to have in wood a carving that says, I have all I need. There's something very eternal. There's something very elemental in its understanding of union with God to embody that phrase. And it's something that you have to live. It's not knowledge. You can read Psalm 23, verse 1 all you want, but until you have embodied the experience of I am one in whom I am not lacking, you always are bringing a pull, a draw, a compulsion to others. So I would start out with, I'm moved by a man who is very deeply initiated. How about you? The marks of a sage.
Yeah. And that account from Richard Rohr, that definition, which he refers to as necessary suffering, the two halves of life of spirituality. There's elements of which it starts from quite young years. We can all begin that journey. But I think it's culminated in latter years where you've walked that through, maybe even as a young warrior and a lover and a king, and bit by bit, you walk this out. You keep walking it out, until it finds its culmination in a seasoned man who truly knows God, knows himself, is known by others. I find the word presence comes to me a lot. Mm-hmm. When I think about a king, it's about productivity and going wider, whereas a sage is about presence. Not productivity. It's not about wider, it's about deeper. So deeper in God, deeper in oneself, deeper with others, knows the presence of God, is present with himself and truly present with others. So presence over productivity. And just the acquired wisdom of which I define as the good, healthy application of knowledge, particularly in a moral, spiritual sense. Now, I think there are sages who may not necessarily be Christians at all, wise people who've lived honorable lives, more honorable than many Christians I know. But I think in a Christian context, also, the sage is one who is wanting to orientate people back to that true source. They're not just there to flout their knowledge and wisdom, drawing people to follow after themselves. That godly sage is a person who's wanting to steer people to a greater intimacy with God as Father as well, would be the other thing I'd say.
So, Brett, by way of contrast, what do you see, sadly, in other men that are aging and have the DNA to become the sages that we're crying out for, but there are distinctions such that they're not able to occupy that masculine space to be what you're describing. Where do you see the struggle?
Yeah, for sure. World shrinks. I think there's a natural aspect of that. I find I'm not as keen to travel. I like my home. I like my community. I like my familiar friends, my familiar place. I've been living in this town for 33 years. I'm real happy to stay, you know. I had a season where I was visiting every continent every year as part of my job. I have no desire to do that kind of stuff. Certain physical energies are waning, and I observe men when they get to this stage, one of two things. They become either self-indulgent, that, okay, now it's time to put my feet up and I'm going to just do what I enjoy. And I often say to men, like, you think playing a bunch of extra golf, doing a few trips, eating at some nice restaurants, even with your wife, you know, is that really going to satisfy you after a couple of months? So some men become quite self-indulgent. Others I see is just a quiet desperation and despair. Their lives shrink away to where, and ironically, tragically, one of the higher spikes in male suicide is when men are reaching 80. And there's reference to that life is so empty, so despairing. Relationships, they've lost their partner, lost their friends. Life has no curiosity, and so they end up dying lonely, bitter old men. So seeing men whose lives shrink, either you shrink to the smallness of your own pleasure, and that's a small thing to live for, or it shrinks to areas of isolation, which leads to desperation. Just tragic. And I find many older men, as their world shrinks, they sense a loss of their strength. I think is, you know, for a man, it's his competency. And as that shrinks, many men despair and think, I'm no longer the man I was because my competency has changed, rather than seeing that there's something that can even transcend competency. You can actually become a very competent in life and wisdom. But some guys are stuck with the competencies of their paid work and the skill set they had. And you take that away from them, and it wasn't just what they did, it was who they are. So the tragedy that when a man retires only to die soon after is an indication that you just weren't, you didn't just work to get some kind of living. You actually live for work. And when you took that work away, you stopped living. So those are a couple of observations, Morgan, but for sure, I see the difference between just shining, bright-eyed, energetic. My friend says they've still got a glint in their eye. There's that passion and purpose. And those whose eyes are dull, and like I said, they're either shrunk their lives away to just living self-indulgently, or it's been shrunk to where it's quite despairing and bitter and resentful.
It's fascinating that you would name the look in the eyes of a man. I have met several older men who have a light in their eyes. There's something that I actually would say, Brett, it's youthful. It's youthful within them. And it's almost getting younger. There's something playful, relaxed, at ease with themselves in the midst of a world that as a younger man, I can't find ease, right? So I'm looking at their world, their predicament, the loss, like you said, of their spouse, or the loss of their health, or the loss of a child. How many older men I've met that have gone through the most horrific loss I know in the human experience, that is a loss of your own child. And these men have a light in their eyes that's invigorating. And to contrast that to something that you would name as dull. I sat with another Australian. I won't give his name just to honor him, but he was in his 70s. And he was coming to the U.S. to meet with his older, wiser mentor, and I was 30 years old. So to sit at a table with a man in his 70s when you're 30, knowing he came halfway around the world to meet with his older mentor, just that in and of itself, Brett, was just enough to invigorate my soul. And what I noticed was being in his presence set me at ease. My breath slowed down. I felt a stronger acceptance of myself, right, in the midst of my frenzy. And I had lots of questions, but I found I just being with him was sufficient. And he told some stories and he told a joke and he actually shared that he witnessed the death of his son in a tragic accident. And Brett, to sit with a man who'd gone through a suffering that's incalculable and to see a light in his eyes, it told me it's not that he had something, but he had become something. And so I want to ask you, in light of that, Brett, everything you just named that are the potential hangups and struggles and temptations, I know those come from very familiar miles yourself. You had to have faced those feelings, those temptations, those risks, even as I've watched you say no to countless opportunities that are coming your way of kingly nature in order that you can come alongside younger kings and offer more of a role as a sage. Can you help me understand what it's been like for you to be in that space and somehow recover the narrow path that most of your peers aren't yet recovering at 65?
Yeah, great question. Yes, Morgan, I think for sure having a sense of God's prompting that this is the time. This is the time to embrace the age of the sage. This is the time to release that age of the king. And one of the practical things I did was to reorientate myself in a number of ways. Firstly, as you mentioned, was opportunities. Every time I got offered a king opportunity, I could instantly say no. I remember being offered a senior pastor role at a church with a good salary, and they'd free me up 2 days a week to do my other stuff with other mentoring of ministry leaders. And I had to say, mate, I don't even have to ask my wife. I am no longer called to this kind of thing. So the answer is no. And when sage opportunities came to say yes to that, which inevitably was more around the mentoring, secondly, what I filled my mind with. In 8 years, I've barely read another book on leadership or management, whereas I read that stuff all the time. Everything I've read for the last 8 years and have intentionally put myself into a regular space. I have a cafe that I try to read for an hour or so every Tuesday morning, but everything I've read has been about going deeper, which is what's appropriate for this sage. Whereas before, everything I read was about going wider. Mm. And I think the third area is really trying to cultivate presence over productivity. And this is the one I'm struggling with, Morgan. I'm a productive person. I'm energetic. I like to get stuff done. I like to tick boxes. It's a great sense of satisfaction. And I'm wrestling with that one. But I think that's truly the transition to just resist the temptation that it always has to be about productivity. And what does it mean to focus more about presence and to cultivate more and more of that? So those are some of the struggles and challenges that I'm facing here right now and have been seeking to practice for the last 8 years, and resisting the temptation to suddenly find that your inbox is not so full, that people are forgetting about you more and more, and I'm about to exit a role where, you know what, I'm not on any teams anywhere. How am I really going to feel about that? Like, watch this space. And my wife, Gil, says to me, do you think you're really going to be okay when you're no longer in the teams, getting the emails and the communication? And what would it be like to let all of that go? So there's so many issues to wrestle through, but those are a few of the things that I am trying to walk out right now. And the last one I'd say is about the sheer curiosity. And even yesterday, we've had a big run of swell, probably the biggest, cleanest swell of waves that I've seen in the last 2 years. And I'm feeling a little nervous, thinking, am I going to paddle out? But just saying, no, stay curious, stay energetic, stay risk-taking, and I paddle out a bit wider. I'm much more cautious with the sets I'm going to try to stroke into. But I got in and out relatively unscathed, and I've caught a long wave down to the end of Sandon Point, and I'm jogging back along the pathway thinking, I'm 64 and I'm still doing this, and passing a number of my peers just going, I can't believe you're still out there. Like, there's no way I'm paddling out. And I think, no, I want to stay. I still want to take the risk and stay energetic. And friendships the same. My mentor, the first thing he said to me is, Brett, you need to keep curious and keep making new friendships, because the older you get, the greater the likelihood that all your friends may die and pass on, and you could end up a very lonely old man if you're not up for staying curious and making new friendships. So making friends with young guys is a good investment.
So good. Brett, it's fascinating, that idea. You use the word in your beautiful document, The Age of Sage, the cross-generational. And I've been really reflecting on this intergenerational in masculine initiation. When I was a younger man, so much of my passion was finding older, wiser guides, and then finding a peer group of like-hearted kings that were in the process of doing the hidden work, doing the excavating. But what I notice as I've been in that work now for 20 years, I'm seeing with new vigor the value of intergenerational community. And, you know, I do believe early in mentorship, that sort of classic idea of someone in front of you that you're learning from, someone behind you that you're drawing along, and someone running next to you. I get that, and it's a really good starting point. But I've noticed, and I'm curious what you think, as we mature and as we actually age, there is this growing sense of brotherhood, where we all become more and more siblings in the kingdom. And as an older man, I need the younger men, frankly, as much as they need me. And I actually find a responsibility, a sober responsibility, to this upcoming generation, because I have this growing humility, Brett, of none of God's work is one generation alone. We stand on the shoulders of your generation, and a generation will stand on us. And so I'm noticing that you said the older men, one of the great dangers as they get into their 80s is it's isolation. They have no friends, their spouses, their widows or widowers, and they find themselves utterly lonely. But that idea of cultivating younger friendships, not only to invest in them, but what they're pouring into you. Can you speak to what the intergenerational, the cross-generational experience has been like for you?
Yeah, great, Morgan. Yeah, I'm a real fan that every man should have someone ahead of him, helping him transition to the next life stage, someone beside him walking his stage, and then someone behind him that he can be drawing up. But then to have us all together in the one space, to talk, to play, to enjoy each other's company, I think there's something really, really crucial in that. And it's hard to see that happen. It's very rare. We tend to, even in the church, there's the general idea that you segment people off and they're siloed into their similar life stages and ages. So you'll see all the youth off in the youth church or youth group, and then there's the young adults group, there's the marries group, there's the seniors group. So we're all compartmentalized. But to get everyone together, and I'll give you a couple of real practical examples that I've enjoyed. A couple of men's groups that I'm part of locally have a wide diversity. And I'm thinking this is great, from guys in their early 40s through to their mid-60s, and to see the revelation and the eyes opening, like, oh, you still struggle with this, or that's still an issue there. And we're all in this together. I have another surfing group, which is mostly people who are exploring faith and life, but we're in it together from our 30s through to our mid-60s. And there's this common love of surfing and the camaraderie that goes with that. But I love the fact that that's intergenerational. And surfing is quite unique, that there can be three generations all playing together in the ocean. And that is wonderful. Another example would be each year my Christian community runs the Great Escape, which is all the males in our church go camping for a weekend. And from the little boys through to the older ones, and we're just together camping out for a whole weekend. We've done it for the last 17 years. And some of those little boys who are now, adults, and some of them getting married, would look back and remember that as one of the greatest highlights of the year, where I had a fire and there was an axe and a chainsaw, and all the stories come back to the parents, the mothers in particular. And it was this great intergenerational thing. So how do we find that? I'm very fortunate to have that in my surfing community, and I'm have to try to actually orchestrate it and help be intentional to create spaces in my church community. But I think overall, we are desperate for intergenerational male community. There's something really invigorating about it, Morgan.
There's a wide range of men in various stages engaging in this conversation right now. If you were to have a word of counsel for the 30s to 40s, and then a word of counsel for the 50 to 60, and then a word of counsel for the 70 to 80. And I realize it's a tricky question, because we are always every age we've ever been. And there are different parts within us that are not yet the full maturity of our biological age. So there very well can be someone in his 40s that's just coming into his masculine initiation, and he has to go back and recover parts of boyhood and the warrior and the lover. So I don't want to oversimplify, but we do know that masculine initiation is as unique it is, it's also universal. So in the spirit of, if we are agreeing that we will be the generation that recovers this piece of the roadmap, and that we will leave behind a generation of sages on the landscape, what would you invite them to consider today?
Wow, big question, Morgan. Speaking off the cuff here. Yeah, look, that 20s to 30s, early even to early 40s. Such an energetic era, so many demands. It's the time when you're going to accumulate, you know, potentially your major settling of a career. If you're to marry, that will most likely happen, and have children, you can acquire your major assets. That's that era. It's an era of incredible energy, so much productivity, so much demands and pressure, but you feel like you're up for it, even naively. So I see that as an era where I would say, be careful that in all the productivity, all the activity and responsibilities, you don't lose sight of just who you are, and lose sight of reflection. It's vital in that age group to have a couple of older people. When I think about my greatest regrets for that era, is that I was probably too proud, and I tragically was perceived as being competent and stable, therefore not needing help. Felt often very alone. So that's that age. That next middle stage, I'd say 40s to 60s, it's a time where the tipping point will go, and you're probably much more settled routine. You'll definitely be in that, heading into that age of the king. Your competency will be quite high. You'll find that, you know, your assets have all been consolidated. Your children are much more grown and settled and emerging adults. And it's a pretty sweet time of just seeing that. It comes with enormous pressures, because little children have little problems. Big children, the consequences are way bigger. And you feel this incredible emotional strain. It's typically quite a strain on the marriage, especially as your head comes up and your wife is, if she's been a primary carer, it's time to think seriously about who we are outside of project managing children, house. There's a whole need to reinvest in that area. It'll be the first time you start to feel changes in your body and your physical capacities. So that's a good time in terms of advice, that change is coming. It's often that stage of the midlife crisis. And am I really centered no longer on the sheer frenetic accumulation and just constantly chasing to keep up with things? You actually should be feeling like you're on top of things. And what is that real next thing? Which would lead us to that third stage. And I think it's a major transition from 60s through to 80s. Wow, there's that major transition. It's the big transition from king to sage. Even the transition of paid work, your whole identity that goes with that. It's a major crisis of identity, I think, for a man who builds his identity around what he does and how productive he is. So I'd say to those people, that aspect of presence becomes all the more important. And rediscovering who I am in God outside of all the productivity, it's a major issue when the children have all gone. Every dysfunction in marriage, the volume just goes up because there's no longer the buffer of the kids that kept us all together, and maybe sort of stifled some of that noise. So, wow, big thing to rediscover your wife and a marriage outside of raising small children. Then along come grandchildren, and there's a whole fresh stage, I think, that people embrace in all of that as well. But right through all of this, Morgan, I think maintaining a godly, honest walk with God and a walk with a community of men is just so vital through all of that. And I've been semi-successful and at times unsuccessful in those two things. What does it mean to walk with God? And I would say so many men have left their discipleship back at their stage of conversion.
Mm.
That's when I counted the cost of being a disciple of Jesus. This is when I made my major changes. Okay, yep, you know, tick that box. I'm not drinking or whatever else the way I used to. Yeah, I'm not sleeping around like they used to. Yeah, I've cleaned up my language. Yep, yep, tick that box. Those were the things of discipleship in my early years. But actually, every transition stage is a fresh opportunity to update your discipleship, because now you've got a job, you have money, you acquire a family perhaps, you get assets, you get a position of influence, you have the challenge of retirement. Every single era requires you to update your discipleship, because yesterday's commitment is not enough for tomorrow's challenge. There is always fresh challenges of discipleship. And tragically, many men and women, people I observe, have left that behind almost to their conversion point, is where they really grew and have been living almost on spiritual autopilot ever since. And so long as you're, you know, tick of the box for certain behavioral things, that's the good Christian.
I'm taking it in, and I'm moved, Brett, that you have not lost heart, that you're at your post, that you're tuning into the heart of God, that you're coming to know who you are, who God is. And I have to just confess the impact. It felt like you had more energy in the last year that I've engaged you than you have in years past when you were at the epicenter of your kingship. Because we have journeyed, what, probably some 17 years of knowing each other. Yeah. And this last year, to see the light in your eyes, that alone gives me hope that you are at your post, you're on the path. I'm being nourished by you in this moment. So I look forward to more miles ahead, to leaning into you recovering even more of the ancient path. And it feels fitting to me to finish with a bit on surfing. I mean, what else could we talk about that's more important in your story? So 51 years of paddling out. So I want you to describe a moment of paddling out when you were a young man, and what took place. And I'd love for you to contrast a paddle out, and you just describe beautifully a beautiful swell and just even the precariousness, do I paddle out again? But and that's a big day with a big surf, but contrasting a paddle out from a young Brett to a paddle out and what that looks or feels like in the age of a sage.
Great, Morgan. Okay. I'm thinking of my probably second year of surfing. I'm 15 years old. My friend Michael's father has driven us down the south coast, and we see these clean looking waves at this back beach, and we decide to paddle out. Our boards are much bigger, chunkier, single fins. You can't duck dive them and push them under the whitewash. You're sort of virtually turtle rolling them to get through. And this is the biggest surf I've ever been out in my life. I look back now, it was probably only 4 or 5 feet. But as a young 15-year-old, uninitiated in surfing, coming from no surfing background, this was terrifying. And I can just remember being so lost, not knowing where to paddle, how to negotiate that amount of power, being battered and thrown to and fro. And finally, me and my friend got out the back, and we got out the back as far as we could, because as far as we could, we didn't want to catch the wave. We just wanted to make sure the wave didn't catch us. So we didn't catch anything. We just sat well clear and just watched the other older surfers, mature surfers. And I was just in awe of the fact these guys seemed to know where to sit. They were able to catch waves. They look so competent and graceful. And me and my young friend are sitting out the back, out of our depth, trying to avoid those waves. And I guess contrast that to And I would say we were strangers in that lineup, not knowing anyone, too scared to talk to anyone, and paddle back in with our tails between our legs. Contrast that to, okay, let's go right to current day. Yesterday, one of the biggest swells in the last 18 months, and I choose to paddle the long route from down at the boat shed. There's a little keyhole channel. I'm not in a hurry. I do a couple of stretches. I'm watching the sets come and go, so I know the timing to avoid the impact of the whitewash. I watch the set come, jump straight into the rip, and I only do two quick duck dives and I'm off in the wide channel. I know to sit really wide of the rip so that I'm not wasting energy with trying to paddle against the current. It swings me out to the back and I'm very comfortable in the lineup. I have indicators on the shoreline of how to line up my position. I can say hi to a whole bunch of guys sitting out there and we smile at each other and there's the camaraderie of a multi-generation. I'm actually paddling behind the son of one of the guys that attends one of my men's groups, and he's 16 years old out in this big surf, and he's wide-eyed and excited. And I know where to sit. I know which waves I'm going to paddle for, which waves I'm not. And there's a couple of times I nearly get clipped and I'm able to just scurry for the channel and then duck back in ready for the next wave. And I successfully ride about five waves without a wipeout because I'm just being more cautious. I engage in a bunch of great banter conversation. I love cheering other guys on. I see the young guns doing amazing turns, paddling for waves that I wouldn't be game for anymore. And I can sit on the shoulder and cheer them on as well. I get caught inside by a wave and thought, okay, that's about enough for me. So I catch a whitewash and connect with the wave that takes me all the way to the beach. And then I'm walking back along the concrete esplanade, watching the surf. And there's dozens of people watching. And a friend with his wife is strolling along. He said, I thought that was you out there. I recognize that black hat you're wearing. I can't believe you're still out there at 64. He said, me and my wife were just saying, oh, it's too big for me, hon. I'm staying on the beach. And we had a bit of a chat before I towered off back at my car and felt the sun on my back and the warm afterglow of a big surf, thinking, thank you, Lord. Life is good. It is good. That was yesterday.
Brett, you make me want to grow old. I'm covered with emotion, and you make me want to grow old. And only a wealthy man can say that, and it's only because of having a friend like you, just someone to just have a candle and give a bit of a glow just far enough down the road that it feels close enough that it will come someday soon and yet far enough away that it feels like a different life than my own. But you've been that candle to me for now two decades. And I'm grateful that you would take your place that's right on time and choose God in every way to become the kind of person that can help the next generation and the generation after that to see together that indeed we can participate in the kingdom coming on earth as it is in the heavens, even in an age like this.
Absolutely, Morgan. Happy to stand with you and many others and cheering us all on.
So, Brett, you're choosing a rather hidden life, and at the same time, you're stewarding this curious recovery of the age of the sage. What would you invite people to do as a next step if this has piqued their curiosity?
Be intentional. Dive in and get all the sort of research and contacts that you can find, people who you feel are in that stage and doing it well. If you've been encouraged by anything I've said here, I've been working on a document that I'm happy to share around on the age of the sage, my sabbatical. I plan to do some research around this and sage or elder initiation. So I'm very happy for people to contact myself as well, Morgan. But yeah, dive in, guys. Be intentional and explore this for yourself.
Yep. And in the website, Become Good Soil, associated with this podcast, you can find a link to the Age of the Sage and also a way to reach out to Brett and understand in humility on as an advocate for Brett. I want to say he is choosing courageously to step into the sage role and not a king role. And so he's not managing an organization or leading an organization. Yeah. So offer to him the grace that the stage of a sage deserves in the pace in which he may respond. Brett, thank you for being with me. It's a blessing and it's a joy, and I look forward to our next round.